From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit Police Crime Lab errors put an innocent man in prison for 25 years. Are there more victims of a lab that was shut down for sloppy and inaccurate work?
I would guess that there are probably dozens more people who were convicted entirely or almost entirely based on a gun match that was a fraud.
A collections court in Detroit taking a hard line on defendants. But what if defendants who are too poor to pay the fines and fees?
You know, taking a hard line might not be the most efficient way to hold people accountable and also bring in money for the courts.
Ford playing catch-up in the race for self-driving cars.
But Ford is much more of a laggard in connectivity and mobility than I think its PR has been positioning it.
But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The automakers who will survive and thrive in the 21st century are the ones making the biggest strides in mobility and connectivity. Those are the keys to the self-driving vehicles of the future. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes believes Ford has a lot of catching up to do, and there is a rough road ahead for new CEO Jim Hackett and team. Daniel, Ford had record earnings last year. One might have thought that bodes well for the future.
You would think, but it was interesting. A leading Wall Street analyst yesterday issued a report that said predicted that Ford's earnings outlook may be need to be reduced by 50% over the next 18 to 24 months. And he paints a picture that hues with something that I think I'm pretty familiar with, which is that Ford is much more of a laggard in connectivity and mobility than I think its PR has been positioning it.
You have in today's column some points that this analyst Adam Jonas put out. Break it down for us, what he sees as the ways in which Ford is behind.
A couple things. One is he doesn't think that the model lineup is where it needs to be and it needs refreshing. That they need to invest more in mobility and in autonomy in a way that shows results and can show results. And, of course, the fact that U.S. sales are moderating is another issue, but that affects everybody. Mm-hmm. But I think the other thing that's really interesting, which really shocked me, and I did a little checking when I read this, to confirm that my understanding was right, was that essentially none of Ford's vehicles are connected today. And one of the things that the auto companies are all about, and Silicon Valley companies that are trying to get into the auto space, is about the data. What kind of data can they collect off of vehicles? About drivers, about how vehicles perform, about safety, about all sorts of things. And General Motors has had OnStar for many, many years, as many of your listeners know, and they've been collecting data off of those cars since 2009. Hmm. So we're talking about 8 years now that they've been collecting data. It's about 12 million cars, and they're at the point right now where they can get like 6.5, I think the number is, billion pieces of data off of vehicles on a daily basis. I mean, that's just enormous. It's staggering. And Ford is moving in that direction. They are building a data center in Dearborn. One of their executives joked to me not long ago saying, you know, if we'd have been talking about a data center and Ford Motor Company in the same sentence 5 or 6 years ago, people would have laughed.
Why?
Because the technology has moved so quickly. And as I point out in today's column, Alan Mulally, the superstar recruited from Boeing in 2006 to essentially rescue Ford Motor Company, did an industrial rescue. There's no question about that. And he deserves credit for that. And there were a lot of sequential quarter-over-quarter-over-quarter improvements in their earnings. He was beloved on Wall Street. But I think one of the things we now see is that he probably wasn't laying as much pipe, if you will, for the next generation revolution of connectivity, mobility, autonomy, as some of his peers were, particularly over at General Motors.
So I'm hearing you say Alan Mulally, with that traditional disciplined approach, kind of set Ford up to fail and to fall behind in the mobility and race.
Yeah, I think you got to be a little careful here. I'd want to be careful on that. I think it's a two-pronged kind of thing.
Okay.
And he was very focused on and saving the industrial business, and he did that. I don't think there's any question about that. But the other question was, did he really focus on where the future was? And this future has been evolving very, very quickly. Let's remember, Alan left the company in about the middle of 2014. Mary Barra came and took over General Motors in early 2014. What has changed in this industry in those intervening 2.5, 3 years is remarkable. I mean, we weren't having these kinds of conversations 2.5 years ago, you and I. We weren't talking about connectivity and mobility. News organizations didn't have people covering mobility, particularly outside of Silicon Valley. Now, everybody, we've got people doing that. I spend a lot of time doing that. It has totally changed the industry. And now I think a lot of people who are investing in these companies are saying, all right, you got to demonstrate to us that you have a path forward and how you can be competitive in the world of mobility and connectivity and autonomous vehicles. And if you can't, I'm going to put my money somewhere else in the sector where I think somebody is going to get me there quicker and deliver the growth that I expect as an investor. And anybody listening to you out there would say, look, if I'm going to get a 2% return or a 1% return versus a 5 or 7% return, who's going to put their money in a 2% return?
So with all of this emerging picture and the comparisons to what, you know, Mary Barra and her team have been doing at GM, how do you think Ford's Hackett and team should be responding to what you call this tough new road ahead?
Well, I think it's obvious. They put out a statement yesterday in regards to this Wall Street report, and I thought it was very introspective. And it talked about speed, and it talked about destroying capital, that we're going to invest where we're and essentially not destroy capital. That is a buzzword in Detroit. I mean, Detroit is famous and has been famous for decades for being a great incinerator of investor capital. They take the money in, they blow it, they say, oh, well, we lost it. Oh, down the road we go. And I think they realize very well that they can't do that, and they're going to need to show results. I think the other thing that's really important is we're just talking here about Jim Hackett. The other thing that they did within 3, 4, 5 days of naming Hackett as CEO, they changed the entire senior operating leadership of that company. And I've been around Ford Motor Company a long time, and I can tell you that you haven't seen something like that in I can't remember when. They moved all sorts of people around. They restructured the way the reporting relationships. They tried to flatten the organization to bring more accountability into it. I mean, they're setting the table here for a different way of operating. Now, as anybody who knows who's followed these car companies, it's all in the execution. So that if they don't execute it and they just move chairs around on an org chart, it really doesn't mean anything. But if they do execute in a different kind of way with a different kind of leadership, then I think we may be having a different discussion. But it's not going to be one we're going to have in a couple of months. It may be in 12, 18, or 24 months.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Big changes could be coming to Michigan's teacher retirement system. Keith Kindred teaches social studies at South Lyon East High School. He offers some thoughts on just what these changes could mean.
Back in March of 2010, I did a commentary on Michigan radio about the animus being directed at teachers. I expressed a common sentiment among educators at the time that we were bewildered by this development. A year later, I followed up with another one. An update, if you will, where I expressed surprise that the situation had actually worsened. Now, 6 years after that follow-up commentary, those concerns seem quaint in light of more recent developments. The teaching profession is now in full-blown crisis, yes, but the very institution of the public schools is also under attack by both Michigan and federal officials. Horace Mann, the oft-credited founder of our public school system, is not only turning over in his grave— he's doing somersaults. Nationally, enrollment in teacher prep programs has declined by more than 30%. And in Michigan, it's even worse. It seems young people are not attracted to the teaching profession, let alone our best and brightest. Gee, I wonder why. No, it's not just a matter of low wages. Michigan and New York, the two states where I've taught, are among the higher paying ones in the nation, though I would not teach in Mississippi or Oklahoma, who pay the lowest. But as the old saying goes, no one becomes a teacher to get rich. Thus, good health care and a pension have always been key drivers in attracting people to the profession. Of course, these are exactly what the Republican leadership in Lansing have been trying to greatly diminish, if not destroy. Just as important, if not more so, is the disrespect. It feels like hate, quite frankly, being directed at us by that same leadership. As a government teacher and a former union leader in my district, I get that they always disliked the Michigan Education Association, or MEA. Get over it, I say, and do what's best for the people. But I understand that politics gets heated and people hold grudges. Still, the Republican leadership's relentless drive to take out that anger on our union and its members is illogical at best and perhaps pathological. Their recent attempt to dismantle the teacher pension system, for example, simply makes no sense. $46 billion just so you can screw teachers in the MEA? A retirement system that encourages people to leave the profession? Really? They are educational jihadists, forcing their views on others to the point of undermining, even destroying our public schools. I know that's strong language, but their extreme rhetoric and actions justify the comparison. Worse yet, they have one of their own as the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who recently would not agree to bar discrimination at private schools that receive federal funds. If that's not hate, it is surely not compassion. The DeVos family has been attempting to undermine the public schools for decades under the guise of choice. Now they possess a new, profoundly more powerful stage from which to carry out their crusade. Vouchers, college debt forgiveness, sanctioned discrimination, fresh attacks surface at a disheartening rate. 7 years ago, I tried to warn people of the path this could take us down. Then a year later, I tried to warn you again. Sadly, the harmful effects of this campaign to undermine the public schools are bearing rotten fruit. Teacher shortages abound, and not just in urban and rural districts, nor in only hard-to-find subject areas like special education. Funding for public education, K-12 and colleges alike, is down markedly. School infrastructure, especially in urban and rural areas, is crumbling. The list goes on, but so does their effort to dismantle the public education, or put another way, to privatize public education so they can have their vouchers and their corporations can make huge profits. I know the public schools have all sorts of problems, but 90% of our kids attend K-12 public schools. And education is still the best route toward a successful life for your children personally and our nation collectively. The time for warnings has passed. If you care about public schools and colleges, you need to take action. Now.
Keith Kindred teaches social studies at South Lyon East High School. You can find his essay at michiganradio.org. His views are his own and do not necessarily reflect those of Michigan Radio, its management, or its license holder, the University of Michigan. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called pay or stay. It means jailing people who can't afford to pay a fine. It's a controversial issue nationwide because critics say pay or stay sentencing has created a 21st century version of debtor's prison. In May 2016, the Michigan Supreme Court announced rule changes designed to keep people out of jail just because they cannot pay court fines. But a Bridge Magazine investigation by journalist Sarah Alvarez finds that could be happening in the weekly collections docket at 36th District Court in Detroit. Sarah Alvarez is here now. Sarah, that Michigan Supreme Court action says judges cannot send you to jail for not paying fines and fees without first determining if you can afford it. What did you find in this weekly collections docket in 36th District Court?
What we found, like you said, pay or stay means that if you can't pay a fine, you're going to jail. And the Supreme Court of the country has said that that's not okay. And the Supreme Court of Michigan has said that that's not okay. But what it really kind of boils down to is how do courts decide whether or not you can pay your fine? And what I found is that this determination, which is called an ability to pay determination, is often not happening in the place where it maybe should happen most, which is the collections docket of the 36th District Court, the busiest court in the state, far and away. And the collections docket's where you go if you have not yet paid a fine. And the judge that presides over that docket, Judge David Robinson, does not do ability to pay determinations. So he tells people, if you can't pay your fine today, you're going to jail. Many people then don't show up or leave the court because they can't pay and they don't want to go to jail. And that kind of begins this vicious cycle where people don't show up, a warrant is issued for their arrest, and they end up in jail because they can't pay their fines. So that it is pay or stay, it's just more complicated, I think, than many of us have an understanding of.
Tell us more about the kinds of people that go before Judge Robinson in this weekly collections docket.
Sure. So these are people from Detroit and from surrounding areas who, you know, got a ticket in Detroit for a misdemeanor. And a misdemeanor in a traffic infraction is something like driving with an obscured license plate or driving without insurance or driving without your driver's license on you or driving with a suspended license. So a whole variety of things. And most people who go before Judge Robinson have a couple hundred dollars in fines because those tickets generally do cost a couple hundred dollars. Some of them, of course, have many more in fines. Like there, I have seen tickets that, you know, were in the thousands of dollars. But most people have a couple of hundred dollars and they have not yet paid them. And that's why they land on this collections docket. What then does not happen is that there is not a hearing about whether or not they can pay those fines and haven't, or whether or not they can't pay those fines and that's why they haven't.
And I know you talked to the judge about this, and what is his take on whether or not there should be a question, can you afford the fines?
Sure. So Judge Robinson takes a very hard line, and he says that the ability to pay determination has happened somewhere else down the line when those people were convicted of having a traffic misdemeanor or in 99% of cases, people plead guilty. So, you know, when they pled guilty, that the ability to pay determination should have happened then, and he does not need to do it during the collections docket. The problem is, like, we don't really know if those ability to pay determinations are happening at any other point down the line. So when people come to him, many times there has not been a determination of whether or not they really can pay their fines.
Now, this special collections docket, Sarah, was set up during the depths of Detroit's bankruptcy troubles. Why?
This is pretty interesting because I think this is the only place in the country where the court works the way it does. So the state took over the court during the bankruptcy because it was spending a lot of money and it was very inefficient. There were tons of computers, for example, and nobody even had email. No one used the computers. So it was very inefficient. The state took it over and tried to increase the amount of revenue that the court was bringing in and also tried to set up systems so that the court would be better managed. But as a result of this, what happened is that now the city is very dependent on the money that the court brings in. And usually courts are totally separate branches of government. But because of the way that this was structured during the bankruptcy, the court, the 36th District Court, which is a state court, really does sit underneath the city in terms of the books and the accounting. And a lot of the legal experts that I spoke to think that that is pretty problematic because a court should be a separate branch of government and it shouldn't really just fulfill kind of a revenue collection or tax collection function.
I'm looking at your story in Bridge Magazine, Sarah, and I see that, as you tell us, in January and February alone, county taxpayers paid to jail 256 people who hadn't paid traffic tickets. And a review of hundreds of jail and district court records show that people were jailed for an average of 4 days at a cost to taxpayers of $600 apiece. But in most cases, they owed fines totaling half that amount. Is this a good use of taxpayer money?
Right. So I think there are really two questions in this story. One is whether or not it is right and just to require people who cannot afford it to pay court fines. The other question is whether or not it makes any financial sense for courts like the 36th District Court to take such a hard line against people who may not be able to pay those fines. And then those people end up in jail and, you know, and taxpayers pay much more for them. It costs about $150 a day to jail people. And many people have fines that are not worth much more than that. I talked to another judge who's actually the president of the District Judges Association, and he said that in his court, they really do allow people to pay what they can and that their collections rates haven't suffered from that. That, you know, taking a hard line might not be the most efficient way to hold people accountable and also bring in money for the courts.
Because you did speak with, I know, one retired judge, David Hogg, who raised this interesting point that there needs to be consequences if you break the law. And it's such a thorny question. How should courts hold poor people accountable for behavior?
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, there is a bigger question of the way that we structure our justice system, which is primarily about fines and fees when someone has broken the law. But given that that's the way we structure it, there are alternatives, right? There is community service. So, you know, the ability to pay determination doesn't necessarily mean that people are being let off easy. It's another way to think about it is that it's kind of a proportional response to an infraction.
Sarah Alvarez, you can find her story on the 36th District Court's weekly collections docket in Bridge Magazine. Just go online to bridgemi.com. Sarah, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We always, always want to hear from you. Tell us what stories are you focusing on or issues or people that you want to hear more about. It's very easy to let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Michigan Radio. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org. And just click on the link that says Stateside.
Challenge. Opportunities.
The next idea.
Education is not a mechanical system. It's a human system. It's about people.
Daycare for children is a fact of life for many Michigan families. But as more people look after aging parents, a similar need has arisen for adult daycare. An innovative West Michigan church wants to meet both of those needs by bringing seniors and kids together in an intergenerational daycare where the two groups would share time and activities. Sue Davidson is here with us now. She will be directing the Bethlehem Intergenerational Center. It's an effort of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids. Sue, pleasure to welcome you to The Next Idea.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Talk about win-win. Where did this idea come from for bringing in children and seniors and mixing them in intergenerational care?
Well, you know, it came about a couple of years ago when, as a congregation, we believe that if we're standing still, we're sort of moving backward. This is a very innovative congregation that is very hands-on and wants to change the world, wants to change the community. So our council president challenged us and said, what's our next big thing? Hill Child Development Center's been around since 1971. It is a NACI-accredited, wonderful early childhood program. And at first, the vibe was kind of, well, let's expand Hill. And then as we talked about it, we decided we are who we are in this community and with this program because we're not huge. We're small, and we know all of our families, and it is a community. So as we talked about the needs in the community, Adult Day came up. And then the light bulb went off and said, what a wonderful addition. We will make this one program. They have so much to offer each other.
Now, you're getting ramped up, and I know you're accepting applications now for this program. So how do you envision the elderly and the young interacting? Would it be structured or would it be free-flowing?
It is a bit of both. We are one program. Our children were very much a part of the construction when the congregation gave up their parish hall to build the adult wing. So now we have an early childhood wing and we have a senior wing. One of the things that happened is there was a hallway that was built that connected the two wings. Our children have named that the pathway. And the pathway goes both ways. So we expect that our seniors will spend time in our classrooms and our children will also spend time in the adult wing. And there will be, I believe, three structured intergenerational activities a day, never with all of our children because we're licensed for 85 children, but with smaller groups of children. We also envision that there will be even smaller groups of children in there throughout the day that we will provide opportunities for just that organic relationship building because that's what we're seeking in this program, is we want our elderly and our children to have real relationships.
And what do you see, what do you predict would be the benefits for the seniors, first of all, who participate in this?
The seniors and some of the preliminary research is showing, and we did lots of research over the last 2 years before we moved forward, is that there is a more optimistic outlook on life. It provides wider social networks, actually better memories, and it gives them something to look forward to. So many of our seniors have such gifts and talents to share, but as you age, you're often isolated. If you need a bit of help in your home or you have a bit of trouble getting around, you're not able to get out as much. That socialization kind of goes away. What an opportunity for them to be able to teach our children. Doing show and tell together is a beautiful thing. We had a bring your grandparents to school day, and the grandparents were so much more excited about show and tell than the kids were. They brought things that the kids were so enthusiastic about that show and tell lasted for 45 minutes, which for those of you that don't know, it is not developmentally appropriate for four-year-olds to sit for 45 minutes ever. But they were having so much fun doing it together that it almost brought tears to my eyes. They were so engaged.
And what do you see that doing for these youngsters? Because I know I've seen it in my own life that these little youngsters, if you talk about a three-year-old or four-year-old, they can be a little wary of older people they don't know.
They can, and we think that is a gift that this program will give to them. People of all ages have something to give. And with the interactions for the children, I can think of every early childhood developmental level that can hit. I mean, they exhibit more self-control, patience, express more empathy. Having somebody to connect with one-on-one. We now live in such a mobile society that not every child has grandparents in their life. And what an amazing thing that the kids' walkers and wheelchairs are not out of the ordinary for them, because it's something that they're exposed to every day.
So to organizations listening to us and go, you know what, that sounds great. We should do something like that. What needs to be in place, Sue Davidson, for this to be effective?
For it to be effective, I think research, research, research. In Michigan, it is a sad but true fact that there is no licensing for adult day. So making sure we had to go through many different organizations to find the top accreditation. We don't want to do it if we can't do it well and meet all of those standards. And putting in place what your philosophy and mission, vision is, we want to make sure that if we're doing this, we are doing it well and we are benefiting the people we serve.
When you think of little ones and the seniors who'll be coming to the Bethlehem Intergenerational Center, what are you hoping for them?
I am hoping that it is improved quality of life for both of them. Experiences that are offered to both the young and the elderly that they wouldn't otherwise have. I think for our children, the benefits are incredibly positive. Having that, the impact and the experience of a 65-year-old telling them about what it was like when they were a child, or doing puzzles together or coloring together. I think for our seniors, it is about gardening with kids and having a reason to get up in the morning, knowing that you can make a difference.
Sue Davidson's heading up the Bethlehem Intergenerational Center. It's a program of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids, offering daycare for children and seniors, and they're taking applications right now. Sue, thank you so very much for sharing this work and being a part of the Next Idea.
Thank you.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Errors by the Detroit Police Department Crime Lab put an innocent man in prison for 25 years. Still to come, are there more victims of a crime lab that was shut down for sloppy, inaccurate work?
I would guess that there are probably dozens more people who were convicted entirely or almost entirely based on a gun match that was a fraud.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was a day 25 years in coming. The day a Wayne County judge threw out Desmond Rick's murder conviction. It happened after it came to light that his 1992 conviction may have been based on faulty evidence produced by the Detroit Police Crime Lab. Desmond Ricks was finally exonerated. Michigan Radio's Jennifer Guerra spoke with Ricks just before a recent press conference following his release and asked him what his plans are now that he's a free man.
Just try to get my life back, you know, as best I can. You know, I mean, it's going to take some time and a little effort, you know, but I'm going to put the work in. I just want to be a citizen, you know, just law-abiding citizen, work, pay taxes, do the things that I didn't do before, you know what I'm saying? And I'm grateful to have this second chance, you know, to Mr. Moran, the clinic, and everybody that's helped me, you know, to get me to this point that I am now. I'm truly grateful. Yes, I am.
The Michigan Innocence Clinic took up Rick's case and won his exoneration. Its director, David Moran, thinks there are others who are victims of what was going on in that Detroit police crime lab. David Moran, always good to see you here on Stateside.
Thanks for having me back.
What was the crime Desmond Ricks was convicted of, and how was he convicted?
He was convicted of second-degree murder and an associated gun charge. So what happened on March 3rd, 1992, was that Desmond went with his friend Jerry Bennett to a Top Hat restaurant in Detroit. And the reason was is that Jerry Bennett told Desmond that he was going to go into the restaurant and meet a guy for a drug deal. So Desmond stayed in the car. Jerry went inside and came back out. And while Desmond watched from the parking lot, from inside the car, the other guy pulled a gun and shot Jerry Bennett in the head and in the abdomen. Desmond then leapt out of the car and ran away. And in the process of running away, while the guy was opening fire on him, dropped his jacket. And when the police arrived at the scene, they found Desmond's jacket, which had some identifying information in it. And so they went to his house where he lived with his mother, Mary Ricks. And he was arrested, and they searched the house, and they found in Mary Ricks's nightstand her .38 caliber Rossi Special. And then lo and behold, on 2 days after the killing, on March 5th, 1992, the Detroit Police Crime Lab issued a one-page lab report that claimed that the bullets that had been pulled out of Jerry Bennett's brain and his spine matched Mary Ricks's gun. No other gun in the world could have fired it. And that was the basis of the conviction. Now, Desmond, who had actually witnessed the killing of his friend Jerry Bennett, had no idea who the killer was, did not know that guy, told his lawyer that that couldn't possibly be true. And so the lawyer then went to the judge and got the judge to appoint an independent ballistics examiner, a guy named David Townsend, who was a retired Michigan State Police ballistics examiner, to do an independent evaluation. And so the Detroit police delivered the bullets to David Townsend, and David Townsend then came back with his own report, which was that they were right, that Mary Ricks's gun, he test-fired Mary Ricks's gun into his own water tank, mm-hmm. pulled the bullets out, compared it to the bullets that the Detroit police gave him, and they had the same marks indicating that they had come from the same gun. And so David Townsend ended up becoming a second prosecution witness. And that was the whole case. There were no eyewitnesses who saw what happened in the parking lot. There was a witness from the restaurant, a waitress, who had seen Jerry Bennett come in and meet with a guy, but she didn't see what happened in the parking lot afterwards. There was no motive given as to why Desmond Ricks would kill his friend.
It was this bullet.
It was the bullets. And the prosecution, frankly, said in the closing argument, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, this case is about the bullets. And so that was the entire case against him. And it seemed like an airtight case. You had not only the Detroit Police Crime Lab, but you had an independent examiner who came to the same conclusion.
Yet, here we are 25 years later, and he is exonerated because?
Because in 2008, the Michigan State Police did an audit of the Detroit Police Crime Lab Ballistics Matching Unit and found massive problems, irregularities. What they were doing in case after case was they were matching bullets to guns that didn't match. And Desmond Ricks heard about this, and he wrote David Townsend, the independent examiner, and said, you know, hey, did you see this? And David Townsend had seen it. And so he did something extraordinary. He went to the prison where Desmond Ricks was incarcerated and met with him, and he said, I'm going to confess something to you. I was suspicious of those bullets that the Detroit police delivered to me all those years ago, but I didn't say anything because I couldn't believe that they would be so brazen as to switch the bullets. But knowing what I know now, I think what they did was they gave me the bullets that they had test fired using Mary Ricks's gun into the water tank. And so, of course, then when I test fire Mary Ricks's gun into my water tank, they're going to match. And the reason he thought that was that the bullets that the Detroit police gave him were, in his words, pristine. And Townsend, with all these years of experience, knows that when you pull a bullet out of a brain or next to a spine in an autopsy, it's going to be mashed up, it's going to be mangled, and it's going to have stains on it from the bodily fluids. And the bullets they gave him were so pristine. So it bothered him enough that he remembered it all these years. But then once he got confirmation that there really was something rotten going on in the Detroit Police Crime Lab, he was willing to tell Desmond about it.
And leading to the exoneration, because without that piece of evidence, Wayne County prosecutors didn't have the evidence to retry Mr. Ricks. So let's talk about this Detroit Police Lab, as you say, shut down in 2008, right after Kwame Kilpatrick was forced to resign.
Right. Well, I should add that, you know, the process didn't end there.
Right.
We got involved shortly after David Townsend met with Desmond Ricks. We got involved in 2011, 2012, and we spent years trying to find the evidence. And we eventually confirmed that Mary Ricks's .38 Rossi had been destroyed decades ago. But through FOIA and persistence, we eventually found the bullets, the original autopsy bullets pulled from Jerry Bennett's body. And they were horribly mangled and stained, exactly as you would expect. We showed those photos to David Townsend. He said, these aren't the bullets I examined. And then we got a court order this year, 2017, from the judge to have the Michigan State Police analyze those bullets to see. And we got two reports in the Michigan State Police. The first report indicated that the bullets were so mangled that you couldn't have matched them to any gun. And then they did a further analysis, and they said, well, one of the bullets, you can see very faint traces of lands and grooves. These are the marks that a barrel of a gun makes as the bullet is flying out of it. And it was a 5R, which means that there are five lands and grooves with a right twist. But a Rossi 38 is a 6R. So not only is it that these bullets couldn't have been matched to Mary Ricks's gun, Mary Ricks's gun was positively 100% excluded. And so the only conclusion that anyone can draw from this is fraud. There's no way that Mary Ricks's gun could have been matched to the bullets pulled from Jerry Bennett's autopsy. And then once they knew they were going to get caught, because the judge had appointed an independent expert to evaluate the bullets, they switched the bullets, just as David Townsend suspected, so that he would confirm their match.
Which fits everything that I've got a New York Times story, for example, from September 25th, 2008, by Nick Bunkley, quoting then Interim Mayor Koch, recalling that audit that led to the shutdown. Shocking and appalling, a retired state police official named David Balish said of the errors and sloppy work from the Detroit Police Crime Lab, I would have never anticipated that it would have been this systemic. It's almost incomprehensible. And he suspected at that point in 2008 that the findings of that audit could lead to payouts of hundreds of millions of dollars in lawsuits. How many more wrongly convicted inmates do you think, David, are out there, more people like Desmond Ricks?
I would guess dozens, possibly scores. Ricks's case is unusual because the gun was really the whole case. In some of the other cases, there may have been fraud in matching it, but there's other evidence that would sustain the conviction. But I would guess that there are probably dozens more people who are convicted entirely or almost entirely based on a gun match that was a fraud.
Is this, from what we know of the audit and what's been said since, was it because corners were being cut because the lab was overworked and understaffed, or was it a deliberate attempt to get someone convicted even with false evidence?
We've seen these crime lab scandals all across the country, and crime labs have been shut down or suspended because of fraud like this. The West Virginia State Police Crime Lab, the Oklahoma City Crime Lab, the Houston Crime Lab, the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab, even in the FBI Crime Lab, which is considered the very best of them all.
The gold standard? Yeah.
Yeah. There has been fraud. People have gone, in some cases, have been prosecuted for the fraud that they have been committed. The problem is, with crime labs in general, and the Detroit Police Crime Lab is a great example of this, is that they're not independent of the police. And so The way that you advance as a crime lab analyst is you make your commanders happy by matching guns to bullets or blood to victims or whatever the evidence that needs to be matched is. So there is a incentive for dishonest people to make the evidence match even if it doesn't, so they can get on the stand and become the prosecution star witness and make everybody happy, and that's how you become a star. And so I don't think the vast majority of people who work in police crime labs are dishonest. But all it takes is one or a few, and you get scandals like this. And you have the recent example in Massachusetts where the woman, Annie Dukin, declared thousands and thousands of samples were whatever the drug the prosecution claimed it was, but she actually never bothered to test them. So she just was making up the results and being a star witness in case after case after case. And we've seen these cases around the country. And what we really need are to have independent crime labs.
That's the answer.
That's the answer. In 2009, the National Academy of Sciences was commissioned by Congress to examine the state of forensic sciences in the United States. And the short answer was, with the exception of DNA, it's dismal. And they came out with 13 recommendations as to how we can improve forensic science in the United States. But the most important one, I think, was to make crime labs independent of the police, make them independent state agencies so they can give the bad news to the police. The detective who wants to, you know, match the gun to the bullet, they can tell that detective, sorry, it doesn't match, and there won't be any career repercussions for that forensic analyst. That's the problem that we have now.
Is that operating in anywhere?
Yes. New York State, unfortunately, is the only state so far that has adopted the 2009 National Academy of Sciences. They have an independent state agency, an independent state crime lab. No other state has done it yet. There's great institutional resistance to this because a lot of these forensic scientists or forensic technicians who work in the crime lab think of themselves as cops first, scientists second. In fact, many of them were sworn officers and then transferred to the Forensic Science Division. And so they don't want to be independent of the police, but that's really what we need. We need a cultural shift. So these people see themselves as arbiters of justice in science and not helping put the bad guy away. Because if they're doing it right, in many cases, they're going to say, well, that guy may be a bad guy, but he didn't do this.
Is there any chance, do you think, of filing criminal charges against the people who were involved in Desmond Ricks' lab analysis?
Don't know. The statute of limitations will obviously come into play. It's been 25 years. And I just don't know what crimes may have been committed here and whether the statute of limitations would not have run on any of them.
And at this point, Michigan State Police crime labs are still doing the work. So that what happened in 2008 when it was all taken away from the Detroit Police crime lab and given to the Michigan State Police is still in effect.
Right. So the Michigan State Police, I believe with the exception of fingerprints, and I could be wrong about that, does all of the crime lab work that was formerly done within the Detroit Police crime lab.
If I'm sitting in prison right now based on a conviction that had the Detroit Police Crime Lab involved, what would I be thinking?
Well, if you didn't do it, you would be thinking, I told you so. We're already starting to get some letters in light of the Ricks exoneration. I expect we're going to get a lot more letters, some of which I think will lead to exonerations. But I think the next step is that we need an independent investigation going back to the 1990s. So after the debacle in 2008, the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office took on the task of going back and looking at cases from the ballistics unit, but they only agreed to go back 5 years to 2003. And at the time, I objected to that when I was consulted by the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. I actually vociferously objected to that because I said some of the same people who were implicated in the state police audit have been there for decades, including the very guy who did the analysis in Desmond Ricks' case. And so there's no reason to think that if they went bad, they only went bad in 2003. And, you know, it's a nice round administrative number, go back 5 years. But there's no reason to think that the problem only cropped up within that five-year period. And so what we need is to have an analysis going back at least as long as some of these characters who are implicated in the audit, some of these characters who are implicated in the Ricks case were working at that lab. And I really don't think that the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, you know, with all respect to the efforts they made with the previous effort back in starting in 2009, I don't think they're the right entity. And one of the major problems is that all the top people in that office, or virtually all of them, were prosecuting cases in the 1990s as line prosecutors. So just asking them to go back and look at their own cases, and I'm not saying they're going to be dishonest about it. It's just human. it's going to be very hard for them to go back and fairly look at the cases that they personally prosecuted and say, you know what, we put the wrong person in prison because of flawed forensic evidence.
How is Mr. Ricks launching into his – it's very early, but how is he launching into his new life as a free man?
So far, very good. I mean, 25 years. So we picked him up at the prison 2 weeks ago. We drove him out, had lunch with him, and we showed him how to use a cell phone so he could talk to his daughters. He has two adult daughters. One of his daughters was less than a week old when he was arrested in March of 1992. Both of them live in the Detroit area. Both of them are nurses. And he's now met his six grandchildren. He's never met any of his grandchildren before. We've been working to try and get him his documents back together so that he can get his license. We've been trying to find his birth certificate. We've been trying to help him in all of these ways. But he has a job, I'm happy to report, in Southfield. And he has an apartment within walking distance of that job. And hopefully soon he'll have a driver's license so he can drive around as well. He has been unrelentingly positive. I mean, it is an extremely difficult experience to be exonerated. It's incredibly disoriented to come out of prison into a different world 25 years later. He was 26 when he went to prison. He's 51 now. But if anybody can make that transition successfully, it's Desmond Ricks. He is a relentlessly positive. He does not have anger. He wants to get on with his life. As he said, we had a news conference today. He walked out of prison and he said, I want to become a taxpayer. That's the kind of guy he is.
David Moran, director of the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
On yesterday's program, we heard from a representative of Native tribes expressing their concern about Nestle's request to pump more water from its well in Osceola Township. The tribes say an 1836 treaty gives them fishing rights to those waters, and they fear the Nestle request could permanently damage the watershed. Well, we have a response from Nestle. Natural Resource Manager for Nestle Waters North America, Arlene Anderson Vincent, issued a statement that says, in part, and I'm quoting, "We respect and recognize the tribe's sovereign status in Michigan, as we do all Native American groups across the country. We recently learned that the tribes had filed comments about our application, but have not seen the comments, nor have we received a request from the tribes to discuss their position. We welcome the opportunity to meet with the tribes and listen to their concerns." You'll find her full statement by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Claire Bryan, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so very much for listening.